Kind of towards the tail end, this is probably where it gets really practical, is, you know, we've all, you know, kind of went through how biblically it's wrong to take a life, right? It's not our life to take. You know, suicide or anything you do to actively kill yourself is wrong. But then you get into kind of this gray area of withholding care, right? So at some point in time in your life, you'll probably be faced with some decision where you might have a family member, somebody you care about, grandparent, spouse, child, where it's where you just have to make a decision about whether or not you continue care or not. What do you need to do? What don't you need to do? For instance, let's say you have your mother tells you that she's contracted stage 4 cancer. And she doesn't want to get chemo. Does she have a moral obligation to get chemo? What do you think? Stage 4 cancer, terminal. Does she have an obligation to get chemo? Lloyd, what do you think?
I think she's not obligated for that.
Okay.
I think that, you know, the situation was real similar to my mom. She was in the nurse's home and she fell and hit her head.
Uh-huh.
And was going to be unable to eat and without having a food pureed. Mm-hmm. And she just made the comment, I'm not going to eat baby food.
Uh-huh.
And she quit eating, and however long it took for her to pass, she passed.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really consider that a suicide. It was more of a, you know, she didn't want a feeding tube, she didn't want a G-tube, she didn't want to eat parade food. And
mm-hmm.
She was in her 80s, and mm-hmm. everything else was going down the drain. So she
okay.
decided, I'm just going to quit eating, that's going to be it.
Okay.
And the option was to have her force fed. And we decided that was probably not what she wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But was she active in her death? She was, but
in a passive way.
In a passive way.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get into that. That's the feeding tube. That's a kind of a difficult issue to kind of think through. Yeah.
I think you said when you think about the stage, to me is significant because there's a certain sense with. There's a lot of stages of catching a couple cells in,
mm-hmm.
you know, something to, you know, a
yeah.
mole that's removed versus stage 4, where you've got
yeah.
maybe a 98% chance of, you know, eliminating cancer versus a 2% chance. Like,
mm-hmm.
is the cancer, what are the chances that the treatment is really going to do
mm-hmm.
anything other than make you sick?
Yeah.
That's a part of the decision.
Okay. So that's one scenario. How about another one? Your father has a staph infection that will kill him unless he takes antibiotics. Does he have a moral obligation to take antibiotics? If you'd like to try that one. Ben, you have a thought? What do you think?
Oh, I think, no, he does not have a moral obligation, but he'd be silly not to.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because, well, there's no guarantee that he'd actually die from it. But
oh, he would die of a staph infection. So, he will die unless
okay.
he takes antibiotics. But if he takes antibiotics, he will live, and there'll be no side effects. Other than like just a displeasure of taking antibiotics for a month. What do you think?
I mean, I think if he has his own choice, God gives us that choice of free will and we choose not to.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So he has a choice to make. Okay. What else? What do you guys think? So the scenario for you guys walking in is there more obligation to take antibiotics if you have a staph infection? You will die if you don't, or your father will die if he doesn't, but if he takes it, he will live. Must he take so? Must he take
I'm
it?
I'm getting hung up
huh?
that moral obligation part too, because I tend to react probably more initially like then, but then I'm thinking about, I'm like, but does he have an obligation to his children? Because he specifically said father, right?
Uh-huh.
And I would say yes in that
mm-hmm.
case, right? If he's a father, his actions don't affect just him.
Okay.
I think there's also something within God's provided the means to continue life. And
uh-huh.
so for instance, like in our cancer instance, death's imminent.
Mm-hmm.
We're just maybe prolonging it a little bit, but I think that factor is much, much, much higher versus this is, he could be middle-aged, like what Lauren was saying, still have a family, a couple antibiotics and good to go. And you can keep being protector, provider, serving the Lord,
mm-hmm.
doing his will.
Yeah. And I think one thing we have to keep in mind too is like, so why is suicide wrong?
You're killing.
You're killing, right? And why, and let's get it a little bit deeper than that, right? And killing's not always wrong. Like, death penalty, we'll get into that. Warfare, self-defense. But what makes euthanasia or suicide wrong?
I think it's interjecting our will above God's will. I am taking control.
Yeah.
This isn't your decision, God. This is my decision.
Yeah. The choosing of when a life is to end or not is determined by God, right? So when you look at suicide, there's a couple ways you can do it, right? You can do it actively, right? The act of taking of life. Jumping off a bridge, standing in front of the train, gunshot. But then you have a passive way of doing it. What would be a passive way of killing yourself?
Not eating,
right? So you have a perfectly healthy person who goes on a hunger strike, right? If he does die, he really is responsible for his own death, right? Because he is withholding, you know, what you need to live, right? So, whether it's active or passive, if you're intentionally taking your own life, right, that would be wrong, okay? So, we talked about, must you get chemotherapy if you have stage 4 cancer? And I think the consensus, I think we all kind of know this, is not necessarily, because you're going to, you know, you're just slowing the dying process, right? That's the best hope you can hope for. When you look at antibiotics, so I think it's a little bit different, because if you take it, right, you will terminate the dying process, right? There is an expectation of kind of a full recovery, right? So these are kind of like two ends of kind of a spectrum in making end-of-life decisions, right? So when we kind of talk about free will, like you kind of talked about that, like personal choice in taking your own life could be used to justify active suicide too, or passive suicide. Well, what makes suicide wrong is our life is not our life to take. It is something that God has given us, and only he can take the life when he deems fit, right? So we have to determine when is the Lord taking our life? You know, when are we just slowing down the dying process versus, you know, when can we actually save a life? And so ethicist, to kind of work through this, they talk about extraordinary versus ordinary means of medical care to save a life, okay? So, ethicists, this is the bottom page 12, frequently distinguish ordinary means of treating a disease from extraordinary means. The term ordinary is the more basic of the two, and extraordinary is defined in terms of ordinary. Ordinary means that all medicines, treatments, operations that offer a reasonable hope of benefit without placing undue burdens on a patient, pain or serious inconvenience. Extraordinary means, sometimes called heroic, are those that are not ordinary. That is, those that involve excessive burdens on a patient and that do not offer reasonable hope of benefit, okay? So when we look at giving chemotherapy to somebody with stage 4 cancer, right? What would be some of the side effects of chemotherapy?
Hair loss.
Sick.
I feel like that, the flu all the time.
Destroys your stomach. You can get welts all over your legs. You can get edema.
Yeah.
It's poison.
Yeah, it's poison. But what would be the benefit?
It could save your life.
Potentially, right? You have like, they often have like 5-year survival rates. So that would be a potential. But let's say that the possibility of it saving your life, living 5 years, is less than 1%. Would there be other benefits that you might have?
Extending,
right? So instead of dying in 3 months, you might get a year, right? But the quality of life would be pretty, could be very difficult. So it's kind of like, live for a year feeling sick all the time, or have 6 good weeks and then decline quickly, right? That's kind of the choice that you're making. So 2 important points should be made regarding this distinction. First, he utilizes terms like reasonable hope and excessive, which change as medicine progresses, right? So if you had a staph infection 100 years ago or 200 years ago, you were just done, right? There's just no hope for you. Get comfortable. But because of antibiotics, penicillin, this is a different calculation. What was excessive in medicine 50 years ago may be ordinary and routine today. Thus, the distinction between ordinary and extraordinary is relative to the current state of medical science. But this relativity is factual, not moral. Normally, we are obligated to offer ordinary treatment, but not extraordinary treatment. Factually, what counts as ordinary or extraordinary depends on our medicine technology. Second, the distinction between ordinary and extraordinary should not be made abstractly for kinds of treatment, but should be made in terms of kinds of treatment for specific persons, specific situations. For instance, one treatment might save the life of a 20-year-old, but that same treatment would not work for an 80-year-old. Does that make sense? Their body's not strong enough to handle it. So there's a contextual factors. The idea here is what excessively burdensome and offers little hope for one patient may be less burdensome or more hopeful for a second patient in a different state of health. And then we'll talk a little bit about this because I think I've been thinking more about this. It should be noted that a feeding tube would not be considered extraordinary means. Food and water are in completely different category than life-sustaining medical treatments. Medicine treats the disease while food and water sustains life. Secondly, when an extraordinary treatment is foregone, death may ensue, yet when food and water are withheld, life will end. Thirdly, when food and water are withheld, the patient does not die from a terminal illness, but from starvation, dehydration. Then regarding a respirator, we may remember that medicine assists the function of the body. When the respirator is shut down, it does not cause death so much as permits the existing pathology to run its course. So regarding the feeding tube, I came across a pretty interesting statement from the American Christian Medical and Dental Association. So the reason why I bring this up is I was talking to a family who, the father had a stroke that pretty much collapsed his esophagus, and he could not eat. And so there are different possibilities where they're all considering, how do you get a feeding tube into his body, because, without it, he will die. And one was like through this procedure through the stomach and through the throat. I mean, there are all these other procedures that were all there, and there were complications with every one of them. And so they're asking, well, what do you do in that situation? Does that fall into the extraordinary means category? And I think fortunately for them, they just found out that there was no way they could safely insert the tube. That was it. But some of the considerations we kind of talked about is, what's his long-term prognosis after this? Well, he'll always be on a feeding tube. But one thing that they brought up too is there were a number of things that were already wrong with him, that were already killing him. Does that make sense? And so this is, I'll just kind of read you some of the medical concerns with a feeding tube. Okay? This is an outline form. Loving a patient should care, should aim to minimize discomfort at the end of life. Dying without artificial nutrition and hydration, ANH, okay? So artificial nutrition and hydration need not be painful, and in some situations can promote comfort. So it gives nutrition. In active stages of dying, as the body begins to shut down, the alimentary tract deteriorates to where it cannot process food, and forced feedings can cause discomfort and bloating. As a person can typically live for weeks without food, absence of nutrition in the short term does not equate to causing death. Then as far as hydration, in an otherwise healthy patient with reversible dehydration, deprivation of fluids causes symptoms of discomfort that may include thirst, fatigue, headache, rapid heart rate, agitation, and confusion. By contrast, most natural deaths occur with some degree of dehydration, which serves a purpose in preventing the discomfort of fluid overload. As a heart becomes weaker, if not for progressive dehydration, fluid would back up in the lungs, causing respiratory distress, or elsewhere in the body, causing excessive swelling of tissues. In the dying patient, dehydration causes discomfort only if the lips and tongues are allowed to dry. So sometimes if you give artificial nutrition and hydration, it can actually make the dying process more painful. Does that make sense? And so I think there's a couple of considerations. Number one, when making this decision for somebody else, it's important to know what their will is, right? Like if somebody wants to eat, you don't just say, no, you don't, right? So there is kind of like a patient autonomy, ethically speaking. Now we can talk about if this is reversible, you're just going to do this for a little while and then you can kind of get off the respirator like your friend did, Gavin, or you can start to feed yourself eventually, because sometimes there's certain diseases where you have to let's say your throat heal, or let's say your stomach heal or something like that, where you have to get artificial nutrition and hydration for a while. But then you get into other cases where let's say the person is brain damaged and they're in a catatonic state. Do you pull the feeding tube or not? Because if you do, what's certainly going to happen, right? They will pass away. Is that euthanasia? And I don't know. Do you guys have any thoughts about that?
I have a question.
Sure.
It seems like we're saying quality of life isn't a factor, but it's hard to look past that.
Yeah.
Just because if somebody's 85 and you have a feeding tube, there's other issues that's going to kill him. Well, if he was 35 and had three kids, you'd do whatever it takes. And so it's not a factor, but it is a factor in some. I mean, it seems like from what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, but.
Yeah. I mean, this is where.
It'd be part of the equation, too, especially with like the brain dead person, too. I mean, that's.
Yeah, if somebody's brain dead, we'll talk about that. Brain dead, they are dead.
Yeah.
You know, with. Like if you have an artificial breathing machine, mm-hmm. right? That's doing the breathing for them.
I just don't think we can like overlook the quality of life. Like I'm not saying like our life is not our own. I agree.
Yeah.
With that statement, but at the same time, it's like we treat cases differently with depending on how old the person is.
Yeah, and when you're older, if you have a bunch of diseases that are taking your life at the same time.
The body's ability to heal is vastly different at 35 versus 85.
Yeah, so the hope of recovery is different. So that's why extraordinary and ordinary means changes with age. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. But we'll kind of get into this a little bit later on. I mean, part of it is we want to value life and see even an old life of an 85-year-old as valuable. The question is, are they dying or not? Are we delaying dying? Or are we taking a life? Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Yeah.
This is backtracking. Uh-huh. But like, does money and like that person's means like also play into the extraordinary versus ordinary means? Because
mm-hmm.
like,
yeah.
I've watched people struggle to pay for like common antibiotics because like they're homeless. So mm-hmm. would antibiotics become an extraordinary means for them?
Well, antibiotics. are pretty affordable, even if you get the generic kind. Now, if let's say, if you get this $1 million treatment, you will live. Or let's say a $10 million treatment, you will live. Well, that would be extraordinary means because you don't have the resources to get that kind of treatment. Functionally, it's above your means to do it. So I think extraordinary, ordinary means, it can be contextualized from financial factors. Like in places like Africa that are very poor, chemotherapy is not even an option, right? So you can have, let's say, stage 2 cancer, where surgery and chemotherapy can cure you, but that's not something you can afford. It's not available to you. You're not under any obligation to take it because it's not really an option for you.
Can I add just a little bit about that?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, like when we were looking for my mom to leave Ukraine, so she, on that time, she was 67.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we were calling like when her money ran out to do the chemo stuff. So she was calling to the other hospitals and they're like, basically told her, you lived enough. Yeah, like you're 67, you lived enough. We cannot help you.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then we were like trying to look other, you know, places, Poland, and continue from there. But yeah, they just, they told her, you lived enough.
Yeah, with limited resources, I mean, and you only can afford so many bags of chemotherapy, you can kind of understand that because you have limited means. So yeah, that is part of it, the extraordinary means. But we always want to err on the side of valuing life and extending life. Now, sometimes it gets complicated. I think it was 2004, Nancy Kazan, do you guys remember that case? She was down in Florida. Well, of course, you guys weren't alive.
I was a year old.
but her story was she was in an auto accident, and in almost a catatonic state, but somewhat responsive. And so she was married, and her husband decided that he wanted to move on with life and pull the feeding tube. Yeah, which would certainly kill her. But the parents were convinced that she was responsive. There was no clear living will as far as what to do. And so they wanted to keep her alive. And in her mind, she was cognizant. And so there's this big legal battle in Florida where who has the right to determine whether or not to pull the feeding tube or not. Because pulling the feeding tube would certainly cause her death. And so it was a very contentious issue. And it's like, where do you err on that side? And it is true, I mean, that it would have been a burden on the husband and everything. He also had other means, like he could have divorced Nancy and given the care to her parents. You know, if he wanted to move on with life. But that was so that's where this gets kind of tricky. Does that make sense? Pulling the feeding tube does always causes death. And so my thought is the person on the way to death or not? If they're already on the way to death, and that is definitely what's going to happen. And if a feeding tube extends that or makes that more uncomfortable, then I wouldn't necessarily advocate for a feeding tube. So I might make a little correction to my sermon more. I thought about that.
How about in a child who's born with severe disability?
Yeah, withholding a feeding tube?
Or putting in. That's what...
Yeah, and having severe disabilities is different than being on the way to death.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? Now, if he has to have a respirator to breathe for him, that's different.
Mm-hmm.
But that child could still grow and still live a full life, although a compromised life.
Mm-hmm.
He's not on the way to death.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the advice I gave. If somebody is on their way to dying, then, but if a feeding tube would stop them from that, stop that path completely, then I would be inclined to do that as long as it could be safely put in. Without complications,
Oh, just like a side thought on that one, is just also we don't know if we are able to correctly prolong life, there could be a medical advancement that could cure X, Y, or Z thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's like that could also be another good reason to value that life and continue.
Yeah.
You don't know what by means God could provide.
Yeah.
So how do you handle that in like the miraculous cases, right? Where like if it weren't for the respirator or the feeding tube for a certain amount of time, they would have died.
Mm-hmm.
But they pulled through because of those means.
Yeah.
So then there's like this timeline of like how do you discern, okay, it is time to pull it or, you know, pull the plug, or like no, the Lord has a different plan, and if he would have stayed on it that much longer, they would have came through. You know, you always hear those things like the doctors told us, pull the plug, and we didn't, and now they're living a full life.
Well, here's a let me go through this next part and then we'll answer that question. Okay. So when death occurs. So death with dignity cases are especially difficult, and part of the problem is evident when one understands what happens physiologically as someone dies. Traditionally, death is thought to involve the cessation of heartbeat and respiration. Today, it is common knowledge within medicine that the heart continues beating for a few minutes after breathing ceases. Thus, artificial respiration can sometimes restore life. Respiration depends on reflex nervous activity, which is governed from the center in the brainstem. Reflex action stops quickly if the oxygen supply to the brain fails. This information became especially important when techniques of medical respiration were invented. The respirator allows oxygenation of the brain to continue even if the reflex center or its connecting nerves are irreparably damaged. As a result, one may be kept biologically alive by means of a respirator. If the reflex center will not function autonomously and one pulls the plug on the respirator, oxygen will not reach the brain and the person will die. This is a case where medical technology is able to keep a dead body alive. So I'll go through this and I'll go to your question. So when did Pope Leg achieve the wisdom and medical expertise of a pro-life doctor? Rehearse the value of life in the Bible's perspective on the sanctity of life. When it has become clear that medical treatments are doing nothing more than postponing the inevitable, there is a clear sense that the patient's time has come. Faith every decision in prayer and seek to show mercy in every way possible, short of actively causing death. So I would say it's brain activity is the key. So I've seen two situations where the heart was beating, the lungs were going up and down, but it was just very clear there was zero brain activity. And the doctors knew that it was really the machines keeping a dead body alive. So as soon as they disconnected everything, they died. The body died immediately. So that'd be very different from, there have been times when I visited people who are on respirators and, you know, they're making eye contact. You know what I'm saying? Like they are not necessarily in a coma. There is some brain activity there. And that's why you want to find a pro-life doctor who understands the value of life, who would tell you if there's hope or not. Yeah.
Do you ever go against the will of the patient? It's like if they have a clear will of like, don't keep me alive, don't do, I mean, pull the plug when it's time. I mean, do you ever go against that?
When there's still brain activity?
Yeah, say for like a feeding tube instance, and they don't want to be put on a feeding tube.
If they don't
want to
put on a feeding tube, you can't do it. Yeah.
But, you know, they lose the ability to make their own decisions, and you have to make the decision, and in their will they said, you know, pull the plug. Do you ever go against that, or do you always say, well, this is what they wanted, let's pull the plug?
I do not. Well, I would imagine there could be some exceptions to that.
I was just curious as a rule if there was like a...
Legally, if it's in print and stuff like that, you can't do anything about it. If they haven't made it clear, I mean, I know Becky and I, we've kind of talked about it. If somebody is just dying, like if I was in this tragic car accident and my brain was severely damaged, and you know, Becky was asked a question, do you keep him alive or not? She would say, absolutely not, right? And that's not a callous thing, because she would know my will, you know, mm-hmm. and what I would want in that case. But that's the case where the car accident killed me.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? They just didn't do the extraordinary means to try to prop me up and keep me alive, and so I could live the rest of my days with severely diminished mental capacity.
I've just seen like families like selfishly want to keep them alive, yeah. And I mean, it was clear they wanted to not be kept alive in that state.
Yeah.
Like, I would say that's the wrong thing to do if that's what they wanted.
Yeah, and I've had to have those conversations with people where, you know, you have two choices, you know. And this is where hospice is underrated. So what hospice does is they have, when somebody goes on hospice, a lot of times doctors will withhold medicine because of long-term effects. Like, if we give you too much morphine, you'll get a morphine addiction. So that if you recover, you'll be an addict, right? But when somebody's on hospice, they have no, there's nothing to hold them back from giving you as much morphine as possible. Does that make sense? So that's like a hospice decision to make. And so when somebody goes on hospice, it allows them to die comfortably, right?
Well, they have the wisdom to know not to overhydrate you and not to feed you when you should have, like, they know which things are gonna make it worse.
Yeah.
And so they just have wisdom in judiciously helping the body to ease into death.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that's different. That's not, you're not causing them to die, right? It's, their body is dying. And they don't, hopefully, they don't put you on hospice until that's just clear. The natural means are causing it to take place. But yeah, a lot of times when you have like an accident or something like that, do you let the body die? Or sometimes you just have to look at what is the quality of life afterwards? How diminished would they be? And not giving medical treatment after a catastrophic car accident, that would be counted as extraordinary means. That's not giving them an antibiotic. But that's a good question. Other questions?
There's also those people that, I know a couple of families that just refuse to get any treatment, like go to a hospital or whatever. They just rely on God for anything. And we can say, well, technology, or we've come this far. I mean, I know that, not arguing one way or the other, but there can still be adverse side effects to people that go in thinking that a treatment is going to help them in the hospital, and even mistakes from getting the wrong doctors and nurses can make. So I've seen a hospital kill somebody too that wouldn't have had the person not gone into the hospital. I mean, there's like so many scenarios that can run through. But then would you say that those people that are like saying, well, I'm fully giving my life to God, and like they believe that their whole life, that they didn't just choose, well, I got staff and now I'm refusing antibiotics. They had chosen that for everything in their life, no matter
what. Yeah, I think, and there's a religious exemption, I would say, to that. Like, if, that is your true, earnest religious belief, then...
Because they don't think they're taking their life. If something happened to them, they would say, God allowed this to happen to me, and now this, like...
Yeah, and what is, it's not letting yourself die. It's like, that's off the table. Mm-hmm. Like, if they were to offer me a drug that would save, like a pill that would save my life, but I know that this pill, to produce it, they have to kill one baby to produce this pill, right? That, I could not take that because of my religious belief. I would be sinning against God. And so part of it, like we talked about financial constraints, right? Like if it's $1 trillion, you just can't take it. If it's forbidden by God, and that is your true earnest belief, then you can't do it either, right? That's not even an option on the table. So yeah, if it is a truly held, sincere religious, like one example, I think Christian Scientists, no blood transfusions, right? Because,
Jehovah's.
Are they that way too? Yeah, that's a sincere, really, that would not be.
They wouldn't even
give
it. So like if I work with a nurse that's a Jehovah's Witness, I'd have to give her blood transfusion to her patient, or she refuses to give it.
Yeah, yeah, and that's not an option on the table because they'd be sinning against God. Never mind.
Outside of directly like theological reasoning, it feels like, yes, the medical system can harm people in carelessness, but isn't that kind of like saying, because the bridge has a rotten board, I'm going to go through the shark infested waters below instead.
Mm-hmm.
And at what point do we,
yeah,
at what point is it worth the, I genuinely don't know here. I'm just saying, like,
well, I think
when is it wise? And
the goal is, life is a gift from God and you want to preserve it. You don't want to shorten a life that God has given you through your own stupidity or foolishness, right? So, I mean, if there's like a hospital, I was on a mission trip in Ghana, and I had some sickness, maybe I wouldn't want to go to that hospital. You know what I'm saying? I guess it just depends. I mean, just know your doctors. And but it still stands that you want to preserve your life as much as possible.
So my uncle, a few months ago, he went in for brain surgery,
yeah,
made it through that, but then his lungs started to give out.
Yeah.
And they put him on a respirator, and they tried about three different treatments to get the lungs going again.
Mm-hmm.
None of them worked, and the last week, 100% of his oxygen was from the respirator.
Yeah.
And he wasn't able to sleep because he was getting agitated, his blood pressure was going up. And
yeah.
Finally, he had enough, and he had talked with his family, and they decided,
yeah,
would that be an extraordinary, or?
Yeah, like there was another case where a guy kept on getting pneumonia over and over and over and over again. And it was just very clear that the body was dying.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think that's you don't want to actively take a life or passively take a life, but if the body is dying, you want to make them comfortable in that case. Yeah.
And I think all these questions, what they make clear is that we have guardrails, right? We don't want to take life. We don't want to play God, all those things. But there is so much space in between where we want to have our own convictions before God, but another person and their choices, that's not my place to judge. Before their own master, they'll stand or fall. And, you know, whether you put the feeding tube into the little baby or not, that's not my decision unless it's my child. And another person is going to stand before God, and we want to have compassion on that parent and the very difficult decision they had to make.
Mm-hmm.
And to know that maybe in God's sight, there's not one right and one wrong answer to that. Because if they lived in a different state or a different country or had a different insurance plan or whatever, like, then is the moral calculus totally different? I mean, you know, whether I take chemo at 43 with a 15% chance of survival, if I decided not to, whose business is that? That's me and God and my husband, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the whole Christian world's business to determine whether or not, before God, my conscience ought to be clear. So it's good for us to have these convictions for ourselves and for the decisions we may face, but there's so many factors and so many, I mean, like we've said, we can keep going and bring up more and more what ifs, what ifs, what ifs, and it does change in so many different situations that we have to be super careful not to have these, like, we know exactly what to do in every eventuality.
Yeah, I would say that these are things that it would be good to talk through with the community, because when you're in it, you're not quite sure what to do.
Yeah.
For the sake of your conscience, it'd be good to talk through the issues. And and obviously, I mean, the big thing is to think, you know, suicide is wrong. Euthanasia is wrong. And I would say the quality of life, you kind of have to be careful where that goes and what that means. And I'm going to read you an article I came across. This came April 6th. What's today's date? The 9th?
Seven.
Okay, this was yesterday. So, from Fox News, Dutch woman, 28, to be euthanized over mental illness after psychiatrist said it will never get any better. So, a 28-year-old Dutch woman is slated to be euthanized next month because of her struggles with mental illness after her psychiatrist said her condition will never improve. Zoraya Terbeek lives in a nice house in a small Dutch town near the German border with her boyfriend and two cats. Despite being physically healthy, she plans to end her life due to her depression, autism, and borderline personality disorder, according to the Free Press. She once had ambitions to become a psychiatrist, but she was never able to finish school or start a career due to her own mental illness. But now she is tired of living and wishes to end her life. A tattoo on her upper arm shows a tree of life, but in reverse. Where, this is a quote, where the tree of life stands for growth and new beginnings, my tree is the opposite, to be told the Free Press. It is losing its leaves, it is dying, and once the tree died, the bird flew out of it. I don't see it as my soul leaving, but more as myself being freed from life. Terbeek's decision came after her psychiatrist told her that she had tried everything to help her mental health. Quote, there's nothing more we can do for you. It's never going to get any better, she recalled the psychiatrist saying. After declaring her decision, Terbeek said, quote, I was always very clear that if it doesn't get better, I can't do this anymore. As for now, she plans to go out. Terbeek said she would be lying on the couch in the living room with no music playing, but she has asked for her boyfriend to be with her until the very end. The doctor takes her time, she said. It's not that they just walk in and say, lay down, please. Most of the time, it is first a cup of coffee to settle the nerves and create a soft atmosphere. Then she asks if I'm ready. I will take my place on the couch. She will once again ask if I am sure, and she will start up the procedure and wish me a good journey. Or, in my case, a nice nap, because I hate it when people say, safe journey, I'm not going anywhere. Next, the doctor will administer a sedative and then a drug to stop Terbeek's heart. Following her death, a euthanasia review committee, Following her death, a euthanasia review committee will evaluate Terbeek's death to ensure the doctor followed due care criteria, and the Dutch government will declare that her life was lawfully ended. No funeral will be held following Terbeek's death. Instead, her boyfriend will scatter her ashes in an area in the woods they chose together as she wishes to be cremated. Quote, I do not want to burden my partner with having to keep the grave tidy, Terbeek said. We have not picked an urn yet, but that will be my new house. Terbeek admitted that she is somewhat afraid of dying because she is unsure what, if anything, happens after death. Quote, I'm a little afraid of dying because it's the ultimate unknown, she said. We don't really know what's next, or is there nothing? That's the scary part. So they legalized euthanasia in 2001, so 23 years later, they're assisting people to take life from mental illness, right? So what do you guys think about that? I mean, why is euthanasia something that we should be concerned about as a society?
Because you can use it to justify death when it shouldn't ever be justified.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it might start for a very extreme case, but when you're taking that decision into your own hands, then who becomes the authority on when it's okay to die? It's whoever is. It's subjective.
Yeah.
That subjectivity is dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Scott?
Just thinking about, sometimes I think it's incomplete when we engage in the death and we think about it, like ending their life, like really, you know, everyone's continuing on in a sense. So like it's more of their, like her question was, you know, is there anything after? Mm-hmm. So really when you talk to people or when you counsel people, it's not, you're not going to end. This is not the end.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think that's an important distinction to make, that I think a lot of the time it's like suffering, the quality of life.
Yeah.
Quality. Oh, okay, well this, soon or later, when will it end?
Mm-hmm.
Nothing ends for anyone.
Mm-hmm.
They transition to be with the Lord, to be in hell.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very different discussion. It's very different counseling.
Mm-hmm.
When you think about the role of suffering and the purpose of, you know, what life is,
mm-hmm.
you're going to exist forever. And so talking through someone from that perspective is different than saying, you know, from them having the mindset that this is my life, and at some point it's just going to be over,
mm-hmm.
and I will be anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of you can kind of hear it in her.
Yeah.
Like, she's ready for this to end, but it really hasn't thought about, you can see the hint of it, curious, but hasn't really considered the ramifications that you know, eternity awaits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after.
Mm-hmm.
Whoa.
Yeah. I mean, what does this whole euthanasia debate just show about the difference between the Christian and the secular worldview?
The worldly view is just kind of like, you just decide on your own. It's my decision, regardless of whatever else anybody thinks.
Yeah.
And the Christian view, you know, it's not really just your decision. It's, you know, God's. You can't take your own life just because you want to. It's kind of selfish, really.
Yeah.
But, you know, of course, with those standards we just talked about, you kind of got to think it through. But in the end, it's really God's decision.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though, that they, like, would make the assumption that some do not have the, like, mental capacity to choose whether to live or not, but then someone with a mental illness does.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, they would say, like we read in, like we talked about last week, and then it's in Love Thy Body, like, if
yeah.
you're disabled, you don't have the means
yeah.
to make that decision whether to live or not, so they would, you know, euthanasia would take their life, right?
Yeah.
But then you have someone that is diagnosed with a mental illness, and then they are still, we're still allowing them to make a decision like that?
Yeah, and that's, yeah, it's kind of interesting because you kind of have this, when you have diminished mental ability, right? Sorry. No. We'll do diminish, okay.
Diminished.
Oh, right. I got ahead of myself. There you go. Yeah, mental ability, right? Where you, let's say, may not know their wishes, or you don't even know if they can express their wishes, like a 2-year-old or something like that. There's, I think it's Neil Gorsuch wrote an essay on this when he was in law school. And the question is, when somebody has diminished ability, which side do you err on? Right? Now, where would this world, the world would say, just, they must be miserable. Therefore, end their life now. All things being equal, right? Versus the sanctity of life would say, you err on the side of life. Now, if you have a society that errs on the side of death, you get diminished mental ability to, they can't express themselves. So you have children, people who might be brain damaged from a car accident, people with poor mental health. You know what I'm saying? Like this diminished mental ability, who decides, the error on the side of death, that's kind of the culture that's going to be created. Especially if you have, let's say, socialized medicine and there's limited resources. They're doing society, it's in society's interest to take life. Because you look at, let's say, keeping special needs kids alive, people with Down syndrome alive, right? Society would, many people in society would say that they are a drag on society, they cost a lot of money, they can never be workers or contributors, right? Whereas a Christian worldview says there's value in every life, they do bring about good. Even the weak bring out the best in the strong. Does that make sense? So there's some worldview issues when you go down this road of euthanasia and you start crossing over into all things being equal, take the life instead of all things being equal, preserve their life. That's a lot of ramifications for society that are pretty frightening. Yeah, go ahead. Lauren, then Ryan.
Okay. Well, I think, like, back to, I mean, that brings up and your initial question to just a few minutes ago of the difference, you know, between Christian and non-Christian and secular worldview when it comes to these issues. I mean, it makes sense when, with the secular, there's no real hope. Like what was Scott brought up, like there is life after death, right? And so, I mean, if they view death as the end, or they haven't really thought about it, and so they're just kind of conveniently putting that to the side because it's too painful to think about, right? Then I don't have to think about what comes after, or I don't want to think about what comes after. So there just is nothing, maybe, in my mind sometimes, right? Like, there's no real hope for life after death in this world, right? Even though there is life. But I think that just makes me think, like, when it comes to these issues and talking with secular people about them, like, why it's so important to explain that to them, that there is life, and because then there is hope, right? Like, sure, like, right now might seem this way, right?
Yeah.
But this is not the end.
It's not the end, yeah.
Right?
There's meaning in suffering.
Yes.
And I think that's one thing, like, we don't promise people that you're going to be happy.
Yeah.
We can promise people hope that in the life to come, you'll be happy. But, I mean, life, there's just a lot of suffering in life.
Yeah.
Right?
That's what I was going to point out. Just that the psychiatrist in that story gave her no hope, said you're not going to change.
Yeah, don't go see them.
But, but as a Christian, we can point them towards Christ and the hope that's found in that.
Yeah, and in a secular society, it's like, well, what is the point of living? And if you start seeing humans as a blight on this earth, as resource suckers, not blessings, and I think we're going to talk about Christians and the environment in a couple of lessons. And but just the view of humanity, every life has value because they're made in the image of God, even those that are damaged. And even those who are sad. And so that's why even people with diminished capability, when we start deciding for other people and encouraging other people to kill themselves, I mean, that's where the Nazis went. That's how you justify killing a lot of people, because they're not worthy of life. So, euthanasia serves as another cultural battle regarding the ongoing war of worldviews. At its nerve center is an assessment about the nature, meaning, and quality of life. As Christians, our responsibility to be salt and light to the world, it is to let all know that life has meaning. Even the lives of the weak and defenseless can have purpose. Naturally, for true meaning to be found, they must embrace Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. Through Jesus, we need not fear death. While death is our enemy, through the resurrection, Jesus defeated it. We also know that our Lord will put an end to death and euthanasia debate once and for all when he returns. In the meantime, we must warn people not to expedite their death, as it is an insult to God who gave them life, and it thrusts many of them into eternal destruction. With each extra breath that they take, they are afforded one more opportunity to repent. So let me pray, then I'll let you guys go. Well, Father, I do thank you for this discussion, and Lord, I know at some point in time we'll have to make those end-of-life decisions, and I pray that we will do so with a biblical worldview and a clear understanding that not our will but yours be done. And should that happen, I pray that you'll just give them needed clarity to make these decisions. Now as we move on to the next part of this worship service, I pray that the fellowship will be sweet, the music will just lift our spirits to think highly of you, and that the message will minister to our souls. In Christ's name, amen. Next week, Scott is going to cover divorce and remarriage.